Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening. This is the podcast that asks one big question in many ways. How can an awakening in consciousness help human beings rise to meet our current challenges to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on this planet? I've now conducted over 100 remarkable conversations exploring this subject with many of today's leading thought leaders, scientists, and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for download. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Jeremy Lent, and we'll be continuing that conversation with one we're calling, How Did We Get Here? Where Are We Headed? And what kind of worldview can create sustainable flourishing? I'll introduce Jeremy, we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend about another half an hour continuing that conversation and taking your questions if you bring them forward. So we'll finish in about 90 minutes. Jeremy Lent was born in London and received a BA in English Literature from Cambridge and an MBA from the University of Chicago. He had a career in business where he founded an internet startup and took it public. And then beginning around 2005, he began a deep inquiry into the various constructions of meaning formed by cultures around the world throughout history. That research is embodied in his recently published book, The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning, which traces the deep historical and biological foundations of our contemporary worldview. It also investigates the patterns of thought that have led our civilization to our current crisis of sustainability. He's founded a nonprofit organization, the Leology Institute, which is dedicated to fostering an integrated worldview, both scientifically rigorous and intrinsically meaningful, that can enable humanity to thrive sustainably on the earth. And he holds regular community workshops to explore these topics through contemplative and embodied practices in the San Francisco Bay Area where he lives. I got to know Jeremy after he got together with his wife, Elizabeth Ferguson, who's an old friend of mine. And in that process, I came to appreciate the quality of, well, his mind and his heart. You know, in Chinese, there's a single word, Shen, that means heart-mind. And that quality and his commitment to make a positive contribution to the evolution of culture and consciousness and the future of humanity and all life on Earth through his work in Leology really impressed me. And although I'd already liked and respected him, I've been blown away by the rigor, the depth, and the scope of The Patterning Instinct, his new book. He's researched this deep, wide, and elegantly written work for over a decade, and it really shows. So I want to draw attention to him and his book. It's profoundly edifying and clarifying, and I think you'll be hearing much more about it in the years ahead. So I'm delighted to be able to engage this public conversation with you, Jeremy. Welcome to Beyond Awakening.
Well, thank you so much, Terry. It's really an honor to be part of this conversation, so thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know, why don't we begin by inviting you to, well, partly explain what drove you to do this decade of deep research and to write this book, and how that expresses itself in this core idea of the patterning instinct, which you feel is so important.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And, you know, the beginning for me of this journey was really that I was going on my own search for meaning, kind of similar to the title of the book, like A History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. And it was really catalyzed because I went through kind of a personal crisis in my own life. As you said in the intro, I'd actually been in business and I'd started my own company. It was an internet company. And in that first wave of sort of IPOs and the whole sort of rise of the internet back in the mid to late 90s. And then things kind of started to crash around me. My wife at the time, she passed away some years back, but she became seriously ill. And I left the company to really devote myself to looking after her full time. But I left the company before it was really mature. And so over a period of a few years, the company actually collapsed that I had built from scratch. I started to lose this person I'd been very close with ever since, in fact, my whole adult life. And it felt like the things I'd built my life around were collapsing around me. And I wanted to, I realized I had this kind of opportunity out of this, it's almost like a cataclysm, to find a redirection of my life. But I wanted to make sure that whatever I did with my life going forward was truly meaningful. And that's what sort of started this whole search. I was going, well, where does meaning come from? These received ideas, whatever they are, the idea of a soul or fulfilling your soul or just each of the different, what's the mind and the body distinctions, all these things that we just take for granted, where did these come from? I wanted to make sure that whatever I did in my life was truly meaningful, was really meaningful for me, not just because somebody had told me. So I started peeling the onion over a number of years that led to, at some point I started to realize, wow, it'd be so good if somebody could write a book for this so that some other people in that position I was in had more of a like a map as to where to understand this question of where meaning came from.
And in fascinating on the patterning instinct, you really did an exhaustive, this is one of the things that's most impressive about the book, an exhaustive study of the underlying structures of dualism and holism and the subtleties of those patterns of meaning really throughout human history, going back to prehistory. And you ended up focusing in a very interesting way on the subtle distortions that produce this model of nature as a machine and the conquest of nature and so forth. It seemed to be the paradigm out of which most of our contemporary civilization is structured. I think it'd be lovely if you could, at least in a simple way, introduce the core ideas there and why you feel those are so important.
Yeah, sure, Terry. So something I discovered as I started to do this kind of peeling of the onion was that the way that different cultures make sense of the universe is always based on some set of what I call like core or root metaphors. So these are like metaphors of the universe, because the way the human mind works, and it works according to sort of embodied scaffolding. We can't actually conceive of abstract ideas without using some sort of tangible scaffolding to begin with. So, you know, just in normal life, we say things like a warm smile. And we're not saying the smile is literally warm, but we're using that as a metaphor because it's an embodied metaphor and we kind of conceptualize from that.
Right.
And so
right.
Cultures do that out of the whole universe. And those core metaphors are crucial to understand because they then kind of color and affect all the ways of thinking, all the value systems that arise from them. You know, and I'll give you just a few examples. So hunter-gatherers, for example, and, you know, humans lived pretty much 95%+ of our history as hunter-gatherers. Their root metaphor for the universe was like a generous parent, like a mother and father giving. And so a lot of their relationships were based on this sense of everything in the whole universe being part of this family. And then in traditional China, the notion of Tao arose, which, as we know, is usually translated as kind of path or the way. And from that came the sense of like a sort of harmonic resonance of what the universe was about. And then, and as you mentioned, in the West, some different ideas came about. And actually, that were really unique in all of human history. And these led to some of these root metaphors that have really become part of our modern sort of foundation of modern thought, like nature as a machine, conquering nature, things that have both positive and threatening negative effects on the future of humanity.
And as that clarified for you, you also began to notice how that was reflected in the subtle dualisms that you found, even in the great spiritual traditions of India and in ancient Greece. You saw the roots in, you know, very, very broadly, and you also then saw one ancient tradition that you felt was really different. It would be helpful, I think, if you could unpack that for us.
Yeah, sure. And there's certainly a lot to unpack there, so I'll try not to go on for too long on this. But so as I began to sort of look deeper and deeper into where these ideas came from, I sort of went from modern sort of mind-body splits into trying to understand how Christianity actually first arose, and then back to the ancient Greeks. And that was where you began to see for the first time the sense of this real dualistic split between the notion of this kind of eternal perfection in some kind of heavenly domain and the world being this polluted place. But what's so interesting, and what I think still even today very few people are aware, is that both the ancient Greeks and the Vedic tradition in India, they both have common roots in what's known as the Proto-Indo-European culture, from about like 4,000 or 5,000 years ago or whatever. And these Proto-Indo-Europeans, and the reason they're called Proto-Indo-Europeans is because we don't even know exactly who they were or even exactly where they were, except it's believed that they probably came from the steppes, like north of the Caspian Sea or whatever. But they're a kind of a putative culture because linguists can trace back the common roots in like Sanskrit and Greek and other what are called Indo-European cultures. They can sort of trace back all the way to a few thousand years ago. And so much so that there's actually dictionaries of this language that they know must have existed, but no one's ever actually heard it. It's kind of fascinating. But that seems to be, these kind of core ideas in this culture seems to have led to what I see as a dualistic way of thinking in Vedic culture and a different kind of dualistic way of thinking in ancient Greek culture. And we usually think of Greek and Indian as being so different. And in fact, one chapter of my book looks at both the similarities, which are very striking, between ancient Vedic thinking and ancient Greek thinking, and then some equally important differences between them. But so those are kind of two different branches from one source. But then, as you mentioned, what I discovered is that ancient Chinese thought, kind of separated as it was by the Himalayas from all of this other ways of thinking that spread in sort of South and West Eurasia, they developed a totally different way of making sense of the universe. And the idea, some of the dualistic splits we have in both Western and Vedanta thought never even got conceived of in Chinese thought. And that's where I think there's so much we can learn.
Right. And in fact, you, in studying ancient Chinese thought, you found a particular expression of it from, 1,000 years ago, really, the Song dynasty, where Neo-Confucianism was developed and refined. And you see enormous correspondences between that view of the world and what's being discovered now in our systems view of the world. And that's really a core idea of the book that I'd love to hear you at least describe in a basic way for everyone today.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, these are big issues. And so the challenge is to try to find the best ways to kind of crystallize these. I think the best way to understand it is that when we look at the Western tradition, first off, we see this dualistic split that really emerged first most powerfully with Plato, but other Greek thinkers, about this kind of separation between an eternal domain and a material world, and then the separation between the soul and the body. And the notion was that the human soul somehow connected with this eternal world, and that then morphed into this Christian idea of the eternal soul going to heaven, which then, interestingly, became the incubator for scientific thought, which saw the world as this thing that didn't have any sanctity around it. It was just this material world for exploitation. But at some point, reductionist scientific thought just kind of gave up on this notion of anything that's sacred. They said, well, forget the heaven part, but the material world has no sacredness. It's just there for us to use. And you got the mind-body split in modern thinking. So that's kind of one branch. But then if you look at traditional Chinese ideas, there were two major schools in early China. There were quite a few other schools that we don't read about so much, but the two biggest ones were Taoist and Confucian thought. And they both agreed that there was this sense, like this force of the Tao, which resonated through everything. Their biggest disagreement was how you're meant to respond to that. And the Taoists were more into a sense of civilization being really a bad thing and being connecting with this sort of uncarved natural world. And Confucians were more involved in focusing on how through community we can connect with the Tao. And then those two traditions got joined by Buddhism, which arose in India, but really sort of got ejected by India, if you will, and then became very influential in China. And then around 1,000 years ago, as you mentioned, during the Song Dynasty, this amazing thing happened where a school of philosophers over a few generations, and actually what they were trying to do was to come up with a renaissance of Confucianism and reject Buddhism and Taoism, which had, in their views, become too influential in that time. But because those traditions had been so ingrained in their thinking, what they ended up doing, by this great irony, is creating a marvelous comprehensive synthesis of these three schools of thought, Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism. And we know that today as Neo-Confucianism. And it sounds very academic and dry, like, well, that sounds like something you'd sort of read about in some kind of university course or whatever. But it turns out that this way of thinking about the universe avoided this kind of dualistic way of thinking in the West, but was systematic and comprehensive in a way that still resounds to this day. And it was a simple way of understanding things. They basically recognized that the whole universe consisted of what they called qi, which we can translate nowadays as like energy or matter, anything, any kind of stuff. But that this qi somehow had to be organized, and the principles of organization that connected up all the qi into any recognizable form we have, they called that li, which we can really interpret as translate as being really principles of organization. And when I was doing all this research over the years, what was so fascinating is that I was also reading modern systems thinking, which we can know nowadays by things like complexity science and systems biology, chaos theory, the whole range of different schools of thought that are looking at how life self-organizes, and they look at these principles of self-organization. And at one point, the sort of light bulb went off that these complexity scientists who are looking at what they call principles of self-organization are looking at the same kind of principles of how things connect up that these Neo-Confucianists were looking at 1,000 years ago. So that seems really important to me, and rather than it just being some mere coincidence or something that's kind of neat or interesting or whatever, it seems far more important than that, because it shows that we can have a view of the universe that is both scientifically rigorous and systematically meaningful, and also connect with a sense of the wonder of the universe and ancient wisdom, rather than having to believe that if a scientific view of the universe has to look at a desacralized world.
Yes, because there was a profound tradition of meditation coming in from Buddhism and of mysticism from Taoism that were just embedded in the Chinese mind, even though the Confucian roots had to do with not escaping from or imagining some transcendent principle separate from the world itself.
That's exactly right. And so, yeah, so a part of the Neo-Confucian tradition incorporated a lot of the great skills and insights of Buddhist meditation. And that's exactly one of the areas where, while they were trying to actually reject Buddhism, these things were so intrinsic to their what they viewed as a norm that that just became part of this way of being and thinking.
Now, you're turning to this ancient formulation for some real reasons. There's a reason that it's not just enough to look at complexity, science, chaos theory, systems science, metasystemic thought, dynamics of autopoiesis and self-organization that are very sophisticated and contemporary, but to go back to those ancient or semi-ancient Neo-Confucianism roots. And what is it that you get from those old and profound roots that is important and different from what we get from system science?
Yeah. So perhaps one way to sort of get at this is for me to really share a little bit about my own personal journey in those years. As I was talking about how this whole process really began with my own search for meaning. And so some of the kind of questions I was asking myself as I was starting this out was, you know, I wanted to really make sure that whatever I believed in going forward was going to be really scientifically valid. I didn't want something that just kind of rejected science just because it sort of felt good or whatever. And so it was a little disturbing when the more I would read sort of deeper philosophy of science coming out of mainstream thought, it was almost entirely like this reductionist approach to science. And you have people like Nobel Prize winner Steven Weinberg saying this famous quote where he says, you know, the more we know about the universe, the more meaningless it appears. That's a pretty scary, scary thought. And there was something in me that felt, no, I know there's meaning somewhere. So at the same time, I was actually pursuing my own learning in some of the great wisdom traditions around meditation, kind of going deep into Buddhist thoughts and learning meditation skills, and also traditional Chinese energy practices such as Qigong. And so it's almost like I had these sort of two separate places of deepening, recognizing the spiritual availability of sort of accessing a sense of meaning from these traditional practices, but also my cognitive brain wanting to go, I want to make sense out of this. I didn't want these things to be unintegrated, like, okay, when I'm feeling spiritual, I'll do this good stuff. When my brain's active, I'll just recognize the world has no meaning. And that's where, the breakthrough is recognizing that there's actually new generations of equally rigorous scientific thinkers really reject that reductionist way of thinking entirely. And the systems way of understanding the universe actually focuses on the connections between things. But it doesn't have a deep tradition of connecting with spiritual meaning. So some of the leading pioneers in modern systems thinkers are sort of on that forefront, where there's one, for example, called Stuart Kaufman, whose writings I respect a lot. And he writes books with titles We're Not Alone in the Universe, like At Home in the Universe is the name of one of the titles of his books. Like, he's looking at the kind of ontological implications of complexity science. But he comes from a scientific background. So he's at this place, at this threshold, where he says, you know, we're looking for this underlying pattern of meaning, and we know we can feel it's there, but we don't yet know what it is. Like, it's new territory. And meanwhile, you have this ancient tradition of people from the Neo-Confucian school and other schools who are in this place of meaning. So I used to feel, well, if some of these Neo-Confucian philosophers could actually have a dialogue with Stuart Kaufman right now, they could say, well, you know, Stuart, actually, we do know what it is. It's called Li. And, you know, there's this whole tradition that looks at the implications of a world where we recognize that what our life is not about the individual things, but it's about our connectivity. So it's like a lot about the focus on connectivity rather than separation, I think, is a core theme that arises from this understanding and from the book itself.
Now, one of the things that it seems important to explore is that even though you find profundity and value in this Neo-Confucian view, we can look back at history and see that even though Neo-Confucianism was once ascendant in China, Chinese culture degenerated and Neo-Confucianism degenerated. And we can look at the last few centuries of Chinese history and see all kinds of ways that their way of understanding existence was inadequate to, you know, in many ways, seemingly pretty inferior to our Western approaches. And so you're not advocating for a return to something ancient. You're advocating for the evolution of something brand new that draws upon ancient sources for a new wholeness that's actually unprecedented, a holism that draws on those old resources, but arrives at them in a way that's informed by all of the achievements of Western modernity and yet not limited by the separated mentality that gave rise to it. And that synthesis is quite profound. One of the things that I really appreciate, and I highly recommend listeners consider reading your book, because it's really quite an educational tour. You go through pretty much the whole of human history, pointing out the what you call the cognitive history of humanity, and offer some orienting generalizations that suggest a new synthesis of a new kind. But it's not a valorization of the noble savage. It's an opportunity to arrive in a new holism that integrates all of the complex understanding of the parts that we've achieved through Western science. So I'm interested to hear you summarize that and then talk even more about what that means to you in your own life and in your own practice and in your own way of growing as a soul.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Terry. And yeah, I just want to observe and thank you for the depth of your questions. And it just offers this ability to really kind of go deep into some of these big issues. So thank you for that. So to kind of echo some of the things you're saying there, a couple of important principles that really arise out of this book are that, one, there's no such thing as a golden age. I mean, just absolutely. There are certain values that we can recognize in different eras and different times and places. But this notion of a golden age, I mean, something we hear in the modern political discourse of, you know, this absurdity of make America great again or whatever, all the way back to the early Taoists who thought there was a golden age before civilization. That is bunk. So let's sort of just be really clear about that. And at the same time, I think it's important not to apply modern value judgments on other civilizations and cultures. So it's not so much that one culture is better than another, but there are things that we can learn from different cultures. So those are kind of just some principles as we look at this kind of issue. And I think another really important thing to get from this is to recognize that a certain culture at a certain time in history can come up with a really deep insight about human existence or about our place in the universe without it having to be stuck in context to that time and place. And there are some examples we all know well. I mean, one example is, a lot of us, including me, view this notion, the notion of democracy, as a profound and important concept of, you know, and that's essential to the human flourishing in the future. So, you know, we know that idea first evolved in ancient Greece. But that doesn't mean that Greece should therefore be the paragon for what democracy means ever since that time. There were decades after the Second World War when Greece was a dictatorship, but that doesn't undermine the importance of democracy as a value. And similarly, a lot of people listening today, you know, recognize the importance of Buddhism as a profound collection of just great ideas that help each of us individually in our understanding of the universe. And that first arose in India, but then it transformed completely as it left India. And in fact, for a long time, there was virtually zero Buddhism in India, and moved to China, Japan, and now many argue that it's most alive, actually, you know, here in California or in the West in general. So the point there is that we can gain from ideas that emerge in a particular time and place without having to see those ideas as stuck in that time and place or related to a particular country. So that's where I see ideas about Neo-Confucianism that are valuable don't necessarily mean that, oh, the Neo-Confucian period was this golden age. In some ways it was. It was actually a very powerful time in many, it was a little bit like the Chinese Renaissance. But there are all kinds of awful things in that society that just feel hideous to our modern viewpoint. For example, that's when the tradition of foot binding for women first became prevalent and just caused tremendous suffering for generations. So I think that's a really important idea, is not to connect up the idea with the time and place. And I'll point out that that's actually a departure from a lot of postmodernist thinking, which says that in order to look at ideas, you have to always recognize them within the context of where they came from. Otherwise, you're in danger of kind of glorifying it or romanticizing it. And postmodernist thinking really came out as a response to this Western way of romanticizing the sort of glorious East, you know, so this concept of Orientalism, trying to find something that was essential in sort of Eastern mysticism or whatever, and then take it out of its context. So there's an interesting area there, like what should we do with ideas outside of their context? And my personal view is that right now, when we look at the big picture of where our civilization is right now, we are headed towards a real possibility of existential threat to our civilization. We may be, with climate change and with our over-exploitations of the world's resources and the massive inequalities, this whole civilization may be headed for catastrophe if we don't look deeply at our values and shift where we're going. And we just can't afford not to take the best ideas and the best approaches that all of human civilization history has given us, and use those very best things to try to construct a worldview that is truly sustainable and that would allow humanity to flourish in the future. So I feel like we have to go beyond these kind of postmodernist ideas, even though I understand where they came from, and take the very best ideas we can get from all of history and try to put them together in a way that allows our global civilization to continue in a healthy way.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that, and I want to explore that with you. Obviously, this whole series, my presenting question for the Beyond Awakening series, is a contemplation of our crisis and our moment. You know, it seems to me awesomely significant. It gives me goosebumps to see that right at this moment when it is as if we are ready to go to hell in a handbasket, everything's ready to fall apart, this great unraveling is really poised to disrupt the very structures of our living Earth and perhaps destroy even the foundations that make this kind of conversation or democracy possible. Even as we're in that moment of peril, we're also at this moment in which enormously transformational breakthroughs are ready to happen and are beginning to happen on so many levels of human culture, in our technologies and science and our understandings, in our understanding of leadership and our understanding of our own brains and motivational systems, the kinds of insights that you're bringing forward in this book, at the level of leadership, at the level of a kind of broader scale spiritual awakening. It's as if we're ready for a golden age. We're veering into an apocalypse right as we're finally reaping the benefits of all the greatest wisdom of all human cultures over all time, being in a vital and real conversation with one another, and people living a culture of practice that's informed by all of the rigor of the scientific method. It's a miraculously wonderful time, and it's this terrifyingly perilous time. And both of these positive and negative trends, and really it's a multiplicity of trends and tipping points and bifurcation points and singularities, all of which are reaching their critical moment simultaneously. It's a wild time for us to be alive, and understanding what that is, how that is asking something of us each personally, what it is to be whole and coherent and in integrity, to be love, to be wholeness in this age of fragmentation. This seems to be the very core question that all of us are up against right now. And it seems to me that you've noticed this and felt this. This book is an enormous labor of love and necessity, to really get down to what's real. And here you are noticing that worldviews give rise to every way of being that human beings engage, that they come from our way of seeing, our way of knowing, our way of being. They all arise from that. So in a sense, you're trying to talk about what's most fundamental. But in other conversations, people will say, well, what's most fundamental is breaking the two-party monopoly and the problem of money and politics in the United States. That's what's going to preserve our future. Or what's really crucial are technological breakthroughs that will enable us to decouple ourselves from fossil fuels. Or, there are many different bottom lines simultaneously at work. And to have a truly holistic understanding is perhaps to choose one that we really do feel we can affect, but not in a way that myopically dissociates from all the others. And here we are in this conversation, both, intelligent, in a sense you're really quite an expert on the things that you've researched, but we're also just naked human, animals here with our soles of our feet pressing into the earth itself, trying to make sense of this larger moment that we're in. And it's there, really, that the most vital conversation takes place. We're full of inspiration and hope and terror and care and longing. What is it like to be alive right now? Yeah.
Yeah, I so hear you, Terry. And I do agree strongly that we are in a moment of deep and profound transformation of the human experience. That, it's sometimes we can be tempted to say, well, does it just feel like that? Does every generation say that? Is this really quite as big a deal as people say? And after doing this research, looking at human history all the way from when humans first evolved, what sort of comes out in the book is that in history, really, there have been two great transformations of the human experience, where the very sort of day-to-day experience of being a human being changed dramatically, sort of around the entire world. And the first of these was the rise of agriculture that started about 12,000 years ago. And up until then, basically all of human experience was basically foraging, being nomadic foragers in bands of 50 to 100 people. And over a relatively short period of time, that all changed, and people were locked into where they were. You had the rise in hierarchies, possessions, inequalities. That's where patriarchy first began. Total change in what it meant to be alive as a human being. And then, again, just a few hundred years ago, really in the 17th century onwards, was the scientific revolution, which then spawned the Industrial Revolution, which of course created the modern world, which again is fundamentally different from that agrarian world of the past. So those are two great transformations. And I think that it's very clear by looking at the ways in which different trends are shaping up right now that really in this century, this 21st century, we're going to experience the third great transformation of human history. The big question is, where is that transformation going to take us? And nobody knows. But one thing I did in my final chapter of this book is actually explore what I see as the three sort of broadest, most obviously identifiable, very different trajectories for what that great transformation can mean. And I do think we're in a place and time where what we do and the values that we live our lives according to will make a huge difference in the future of humanity.
So that conviction leads you to a whole host of different ways of orienting, and part of that is based on a very interesting analysis that you offer. You take a look at the end of the book at the possible futures, and one of the narratives, as we've admitted, is a narrative of collapse. There's another narrative that says that we're going to have enormous technological breakthroughs that are going to transform all of our limitations, and we're going to be able to live in a kind of economized harmony, a kind of techno-utopian possibility. But you find that less credible than the idea that we're going to end up splitting into two forms of human beings, the technologically advantaged, genetically engineered superior race that has the benefits of the top edge of the inequality split and all the benefits of wealthy people are enjoying now, but you know, empowered by a whole new dimension of technological progress, and then the broad mass of humanity, the naturals, being pretty much impoverished and living a much more limited life. But
right.
Then,
yeah.
Then, why don't you unpack how you see the near future from your different analyses?
And that scenario that you were just describing really well, Terry, is what I call the techno-split scenario. And I think it's important for us to get a better sense of that. And in fact, something I view as something I hope the book does is really open a debate on this issue, which generally tends to be ignored when we look at the future. Because, I mean, probably all of us listening in today have heard some, you know, especially here in California, have heard some of these kind of techno visions for the future. And one person who's become well known is Raymond Kurzweil, who talks about the singularity being near when artificial intelligence becomes even more intelligent than human intelligence. And then there's notions of neural enhancements and actually getting literally connected to the internet through our minds. And that sounds like science fiction, but it's probably no more than a couple of decades away at most. And then, of course, there's genetic enhancement, where all this research is being done as to how to produce, you know, smarter new generations, et cetera. So one of the concerns I have is that, like, right now we know that the world is riven by the most extreme and grotesque inequalities, where and this statistic is hard to even get your head around, but the wealthiest 8 men in the world right now own as much wealth as the entire lower half of the human race, of the human population, 3.5 billion people. So these inequalities are so extreme, but we're really looking at the possibility that within a couple of generations, we might actually bifurcate into two different races. You know, these affluent folks who just become like these kind of uber humans, and the rest of us, or people who are not part of that group, are left in their own version of collapse. But to the wealthy, to the affluent, maybe 500 million or billion people, it won't feel like collapse. It'll be, oh yeah, all this terrible thing happening to everyone else. But they will get less and less even concerned about it, because just like they'll view it as almost another species is suffering so much rather than themselves. And I think in many ways that, and from a moral perspective, that is almost even worse than a total collapse of civilization, because it's equivalent to sort of like the Titanic sinking and the wealthy, you know, having their own gilded life raft, their own luxury life raft they get on while they just watch everybody else sink behind them. And I think that whenever you hear people talk about these wonders of technology, you really need to ask yourself, is this going to be so wonderful for these like billions of people who right now don't even get enough to eat, don't have access to running water? You know, like, or are we just talking about these technologies applying to this kind of group of people that live in the developed world, or the minorities that are wealthy in other countries too? So I think that is crucial. And honestly, I think that that may be the most likely scenario as to where we're headed, unless as a human population, we wake up to that and say, no, this is not sufficient. And ultimately, I think it comes down to how we define what it means to be a human being. People who believe in this kind of this excitement of technological possibility, they sort of oftentimes they'll define being a human as always reaching for more. Like, you know, our mind is always looking to create new things, new possibilities, which is all very exciting and inspiring. But, you know, there's another definition of human being really comes from that you see, like, say, in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, really humanity as a brotherhood and sisterhood, a family, and this recognition that all humans should have access to rights to enjoy life and to be able to have equal possibilities of leading a fulfilling life. And I think we're giving up on that definition in that techno-split scenario. So I think that's very important. But then there is this third scenario. If we look at collapse, techno-split, the third scenario is one of a real potential human flourishing. And that is one that, you know, sometimes seems so far away when we look at things that are going on right now in the world. But I feel there's a lot of hope for the possibility of that path. And like, if you'd like, Terry, I'm happy to go there and we can talk about that a little bit more.
Well, I would have just begun to ask you about it, so please just go right ahead.
Okay, great, sure. Basically this notion of human flourishing, I think we're only going to get there by looking at the shifting of our underlying values. Because, you know, and you know, you were talking before, Terry, about this sense of different people could say, no, what we really need to do is like change the two-party system, or what we really need to do is find a technological solution to this or that that's going on out there. But I think one way we can look at our total global system right now is a little bit like using the analogy of a gigantic software. And, you know, imagine that, like some software where the operating system's got some fundamental flaws, but we're not looking at the operating system. We're looking at sort of software bug fixes. And so what we see is like the bugs keep getting bigger and bigger and we keep fixing them. But when you fix them, a new bug arises, but it's even worse than the worst one. And so you're doing all these workarounds. But you're only going to really fix that software if you look at the operating system itself and say, oh, this was designed in this way that structurally is always going to cause these kind of problems. And when you kind of take that analogy and look at our modern global civilization, we look at the underlying values that have arisen from these core metaphors of our civilization, these notions of conquering nature, nature as a machine. These are all metaphors of separation. And we get to realize that some of the values and assumptions that we take for granted in our current civilization have to change if we're going to move towards that place of great, of what I call a great transformation in human society. But the reason I have a lot of hope is that I think many of us, and not just the kind of people listening to this podcast today, but millions and hundreds of millions of people around the world actually have these values because they're really core human values. It's just that the world that we're told about, the global media that is barraged into us, offers a different set of values, which leads to a dissonance people have between what they feel is right and what they're told is right. And I think that that's where each of us who can look at some of these things and share our own sense of values with the world can really have a meaningful impact as to where we're headed in the future.
Now, as you're unpacking that, I'm remembering, because I've read at your book, you know, fairly deeply. I haven't read every single chapter in depth, but one of the things I was impressed with in the last chapter of the book is how three core values emerge from this kind of worldview you're talking about. One is an emphasis on the quality of life rather than material possessions. And that would mean prioritizing progress in terms of true happiness and value in our relationships and in our relationship to the, you know, let's say our spiritual lives. And then you'd also see the second core value being an emphasis on our shared humanity as a basis for political, social, and economic choices, so that there would be some measure of real fairness and dignity for everyone, rather than maximizing our own and our group's best advantages. And the third was to build our civilization's future on the basis of environmental sustainability, so the natural world's flourishing as the foundation for our own flourishing would be built in. And that you know, that harmonizes, you know, beautifully with a lot of the attitudes that, you know, most of our postmodern new age friends, you know, hold, and which seems so impotent apparently in our current political climate, and yet I resonate completely with them. And it does seem to me that you're intuiting a path whereby those values could be ascendant, even though they don't seem to compete on an equal footing with the domination motives that seem to be carrying the day. You know, in a sense, we're asking the question, how can cooperation, how can love compete in this competitive environment, you know, both at the level of events and at the level of ideas. So how do you see that coming about when you open into your hopeful envisioning of our shared future? What does that look like?
Yeah, I'd love to go there, Terry. And just for a moment, before I go there, I just wanted to point out something else relating to what you were saying, that it certainly right now, with this kind of absurd, crazed person, this monster in the White House, and with the divisions in U.S. politics and the Brexit in Europe and things like that, it is easy to look at these things and go, oh, things are just moving in the wrong direction. But when you take a broader sweep and look from a much sort of bigger scale, it's really unequivocally true, I think, that there's been a lot of very the norms that we have in today's world are a lot more advanced and humane than the norms even just 100 or a couple of hundred years ago, never mind over hundreds of years. You know, a perfect example is things like something like slavery, which was really understood as being an integral part of the economic system a couple of hundred years ago. And now, of course, nobody would even dream of trying to defend slavery, even if it does happen in a few places around the world, as we unfortunately know. But that's kind of an example, you know, and even more recently, something like same-sex marriage was considered unthinkable not too long ago, and now has become really just generally accepted in many advanced countries, even in the United States, which can hardly be considered an advanced country anymore, I'm afraid. But to get to your core question, how can we actually make a difference? I think that each of those values you expressed, we can make a difference both in our own internal practice and the choices we make in our individual lives, and by being engaged in the political dialogue on those issues. And I'll just sort of get a little bit more tangible on those. So that first value you were talking about, of focusing on the quality of life rather than on the material possessions. Well, it's very, from our individual perspective, of course, probably, and I imagine pretty much everyone listening to this podcast has got their own personal practices, maybe meditation, maybe other kinds of practices about connecting with themselves in terms of quality. And that can apply in the choices and the decisions we make each day. Like, we can decide not to be pulled into this kind of consumer frenzy that is forced on us by the media and by the whole system around us. And so when it's time to make purchase decisions, we can recognize that the decisions we make actually affect the world that we are integrally related to. And so we can make decisions of purchasing either things within a circular economy and like the whole notion of reusing and recycling and sharing, or at least not buy into the corporate world by just being kind of thoughtful as to where we go with our food buying, etc. So that's kind of on the personal place. And on the sort of political layer, it's so interesting, like our whole modern system is based on this notion of GDP, that, it's like the scorecard by which an economy is doing well or not. Is GDP increasing by 3% or not? And of course, GDP only measures the rate at which the natural world and human activities are monetized and brought into this monetary economy. So something that when I envision a potential for a future flourishing world, it would be a world where the scorecard of a country was measured by things like and there are other measures out there, like a sort of a happiness index. And there are actually very tangible measures that have been developed for an indexing of how a country's true level of well-being is growing rather than just the rate of their consumption. So that's an example of how something like that can be shifting at the personal and the political layer. And then if we move to this notion of that second value, which is basically looking at our shared humanity. So rather than making decisions based on what's just right for me or my family, or what's just right for my parochially defined group, looking at all of humanity as being connected and saying what's best for our whole society, for the whole global society. And there, really, we can make decisions. We can, with our own personal practice, we can emphasize compassion, and we can look at what compassion means when we apply it to our activities, what we do with our lives. And then on the political sphere, really that comes to putting our energy into fighting for things that we know are right, whether it's a basic minimum wage for people, or just any of the different movements that we see around us where we can connect up and really help others that might be facing more threats than we are individually by what's currently going on in our society. And then finally, just that third value is really connecting with the natural world and recognizing that. And again, in our own practice, we can make conscious efforts to really deepen our own sense of being part of nature, and recognizing that we're not just human beings trying to fight for nature. Each of us as human beings, we are nature, and we're nature defending itself. And again, a vision for a political future where that is in a kind of ensconced in our actual political framework. Just like we have right now a UN Declaration of Human Rights, I'd see a future where there could be a UN Declaration of the Rights of Nature, And there's actually a movement out there of people around the world actually creating legal frameworks for what that could look like, where basically it would become a crime equivalent to like a crime of genocide. There would be a crime of ecocide for big corporations to destroy ecologies the way they can do now without even having to worry about it. So these are just some of the potential elements of a framework for a future of flourishing, both for ourselves individually and for where our society can go. So, Terry, I'm not hearing you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was just worried that I may have lost you for a second.
Yes, you did. You lost me for a second. I think it's time for us to invite questions. So if you've called in on your telephone, please press *2 on your telephone keypad, and you can raise your hand. Or if you're listening on your computer, just type a question into the window there. And I want you to know a little more about how you can find out about Jeremy's work. This important new book, The Patterning Instinct, is now available to buy online or at leading bookstores. He wanted me to mention that in the Bay Area, that includes Books Incorporated in Berkeley, Book Passage in Corte Madera, and Kepler's in Menlo Park. You can find out more about Jeremy's work at his website, jeremylent.com. And you can find out more about the integrative framework, Leology, which is his integration of this in a sense of a kind of a coherent teaching at leology.org. That's leology.org. And on that same website, you can learn about the bimonthly Leology workshops that he holds in Berkeley, which are open to the public. You can arrange to come. I also want to make sure that you know about my work. My online course, Integral Spiritual Practice, which is an 8-session course to activate your conscious evolution and awaken the full potential of your body, mind, and spirit, is being offered now. And you can learn all about this new online course at ispcourse.com. That's ISP as in Integral Spiritual Practice, ispcourse.com. And this is a very rich course that I developed over the course of years, really. And it's the only way I know to be taken right where you live in a step-by-step process through the process of establishing a daily, ongoing, doable, heartfelt, integral practice in the company of a worldwide company of sincere practitioners. And this involves going beyond seeking. It's a matter of living this kind of holism we've been discussing. The course will be starting pretty soon, so I encourage you to act now and take a serious look at it at ispcourse.com. There's really no substitute for a daily practice and a life of practice. That's what powered Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama. A whole life of practice is what creates the conditions for transformation and leadership. And I held a free online seminar that introduced all of this called The 5 Spiritual Myths That Sabotage Your Conscious Evolution. And you can access that recording by going to terrypatton.com, where you can also find a rich body of articles and blog posts and audios and videos and events, and connect with my mailing list. If you click events there, the free seminar is listed on June 17th, and you can click through to register for the free recording. Each of these 5 myths is a distortion of a deep spiritual truth. And in the free seminar and the 8-week course, I teach the practical actions you can take to undergo the cognitive, energetic, and feeling shifts into a new state and stage of consciousness. You're also invited to join me in person next month at a 5-day workshop at Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. I'll be co-teaching this with Sarah Marshank July 30th through August 4th. And it's going to be a very special event because Esalen's been closed for 6 months due to the landslides from the big rains this past winter. And it's going to reopen just 2 days before our workshop begins. So it's going to be a very special time. It'll be probably a relatively small, intimate group of people at Esalen altogether and in our workshop. And you can find out more details about that and also a link to register at terrypatton.com. Now, remember, if you've called in on the phone, you can press *2. And if you're listening online, you can type your question in for Jeremy or me. So, turning over to look at the questions. I want to open it up to someone who's called in by phone but doesn't have a name associated with it. This is a 570 area code. You're on the air. Please go ahead with your question. Hi.
Oh, hi, Terry, and say hello to your guest. Thank you. I appreciate it. I love the lecture. This is my question, and it's funny you mentioned the Titanic. It's my local theater showing the Titanic, and today, and I'm going to go see it, but that I often feel like I'm on the Titanic, and this is kind of this sense of hopelessness that I can't seem to shake, that the powers that you've alluded to, and you've addressed it kind of, but how does someone almost, I've given up hope that it can be turned around, that the powers are too strong and there's more things than even a two-party system that they're doing, but that can then someone actually work in hopelessness in the situation? And I ask this with all seriousness and respect, because that's where I've been for several years, where I've just given up. And yet, I'm still alive, so what the hell can I do? And so it's a very tough place to be in a hopeless place. I feel like I'm on the Titanic, and am I going to listen to the band playing as it sinks or what? So thank you, and I'll listen. I appreciate both of you.
Thanks
so much. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And that, you know, I think you're speaking for so many of us, and even those of us that don't characterize themselves as feeling hopeless, I'm sure, have been through periods of feeling just like you're feeling. I mean, how can we not, with any kind of heart or soul, like look at what's going on and not feel that so much? So, yeah, I think that's a crucial question. And there's a couple of ways in which I look at that. One that is very meaningful to me is actually work that Rebecca Solnit has done. And some people may know a book that she's written called Hope in the Dark, which exactly looks to exactly this issue. And an important point that she comes to is that actually hope is not a prognostication. You know, you can be optimistic or you can be pessimistic about the future. And that can be like a prognostication, things are going to get better or going to get worse. But hope is actually more like a state of mind. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you believe things are going to get better, but it's just this recognition that there is a possibility that things can shift. And there are two important elements underlying that. One of them is what I call the non-linearity of change. And there's something actually you'll see throughout this book is this recognition that human society is a complex system. And something we know about complex systems is they work in non-linear ways, which means that basically you can't just keep drawing a line and saying the future's going to be a continuation of that line. And that's both a positive and a negative thing when we look at the future, because one thing it means is that, well, we could actually, while we're growing in the economy right now, it could collapse. But at the same time, we can say that this growth in the powers of the corporate systems and the billionaires over the rest of us doesn't have to stay like that indefinitely. In fact, that's what could collapse instead, and we could look at something different. So that's one important element when we look at the future, is to recognize that it's nonlinear. But maybe the most important element of all is to recognize that in this nonlinear space, it's kind of this complex network of all these different dynamics that none of us can actually predict, that each of us individually are actually part of those networks. And by being part of those networks, the approach that we take to the world, can actually have a significant impact through its connections with all these other nodes of people doing their activities elsewhere. So it's a little bit like an ecosystem where each of us are making a difference, but none of us are going to be making so much of a difference that we can say, oh, I'm the one who made this or that change. But by all of us working together through this incredibly complex network, a little bit like a sort of fungal system connecting trees under the ground that nobody sees, but it's one of these underlying things that actually causes health to happen out there above ground. Those are the ways in which we can make a difference, which requires some element of faith in a way. It means realizing that the stuff that we do, we may not see the actual direct impact, but we don't know what kind of differences those things can make years from now. So, you know, when Martin Luther King was out there and when he got assassinated, there's no way that he could have known, for example, you know, that within a lifetime or less, there'd be an African-American president in the United States. I mean, these are the kind of things that we can never know until we're actually, until the future takes its own shape. So those are some of the things, because I've been in that place you said myself many times, and these are some of the ways in which I find myself taking enough sense of hope as a frame of mind to really recognize what I do and really can make a difference. This is not a spectator sport. We're all in this together. So thank you for that.
Yeah. This is such a core question, and it's one that I think every one of us has to work with. Even those of us who are in a very positive and hopeful orientation have had to do our own battles with this strong current of sense of hopelessness and despair. And one of the things that I had to come to, number one, was to break through the denial that's there in our media and our culture. The denial of the seriousness of our situation and the enormous ways that the deck really does seem to be stacked against all of the positive changes that I would love to see. But we really, you know, human knowledge is, even though there are countless books and, you know, what are there, petabytes of information on the web, human knowledge is tiny compared to the totality of this immense nonlinear and unpredictable system. And we really do not know enough to be pessimistic. We only know enough to know that we are co-creating the future even right now. By having this conversation, we're participating in the creation of a somewhat different future than if we didn't have this conversation or if this conversation didn't go as deeply. And so there's something in the humanity. You know, I really appreciate your confessing your place of difficulty and being vulnerable. That vulnerability is a piece of the process through which we make authentic contact with one another. And that authentic contact is the kind of connectivity that this kind of holism that Jeremy is celebrating is really woven out of. And there's something very beautiful that Jeremy first showed me when I visited one of his Leology teachings back before he moved to Berkeley, and which he repeats in the book. It's a poem from the Neo-Confucians that really says something about this holistic view that I just like to offer. Heaven is my father, and earth is my mother, and I, a small child, find myself placed intimately between them. What fills the universe, I regard as my body. What directs the universe, I regard as my nature. All people are my brothers and sisters. All things are my companions. You know, Jeremy, this is if there were a short number of words that summarized your point of view, these might be them. I wonder if you'd like to say more about that.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Terry, for bringing that up. That actually is, in my view, one of the greatest and most profound statements that I've ever come across in all my research of all human description of our place in the universe. And that's actually a Neo-Confucian philosopher called Chang Tsai who said that. And it's recognized in China as a really, as a major central motif of Neo-Confucian thought. And, you know, I think that that is the kind of vision that can allow us that place of great transformation. When you were talking about those values that that a real future flourishing can actually be based on, that encapsulates it. It's that recognition of connection. It's a recognition of connection that goes back to our hunter-gatherer roots. You remember I was talking about that core metaphor of hunter-gatherers as recognizing the natural world as a giving parent. And it goes all the way through to this sense of modern systems thinking that recognizes the intrinsic interconnectedness of all life in the world and the fact that we share 50% of our DNA with a common housefly, that we're all part of this together. There was one at COP21 a couple of years ago in Paris, there was a motif that went around that really stayed with me that I think is so important. It went like this. It said, we are not defending nature. We are nature defending itself. And I think that is so true.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, there are some questions that people have typed in, and here's one that's quite focused that you might find interesting to grapple with. Dexter from Eugene writes in, Jeremy, I appreciate your deep analysis of the evolution of human consciousness structures, but your solution approach seems anchored in the postmodern green worldview. How do you understand and incorporate Ken Wilber's integral theory into your work?
I'm not sure that I would say I incorporate Ken Wilber's theory into my work. And take somewhat of an issue with one of the sort of key elements of his theory, this notion of the sort of the green meme and there being this concern about it not being the most fully evolved place to be. And honestly, I don't, when I look at the possibilities arising from an integrated worldview, I don't see the same hierarchical stages that, as I understand it, Ken Wilber sees in the integral worldview. Rather, I see the possibility of integrating different things in one, in a more fully sort of connected web of meaning. And on a personal level, in the Leology workshops, I kind of explore what integration means about really being in touch with all the different layers of what we are as human beings and approaching that with kindness and recognizing that we can, all of that can be given a place of meaning in our own existence. And as we look at our human relation to the rest of the world out there, it does involve this recognition that we are engaged in it, that from a moral and ethical standpoint, just like that quote that Terry read, the universe is my body and the people are my brothers and sisters, which means that when other people are suffering, it's not enough to just, try to offer them a way to find their own sort of spiritual growth to deal with that suffering. Some of that suffering is very real. When people are hungry, when people are discriminated against so that their lives can't function properly, we're not in a position to just say to them, well, they need to kind of grow to get to a better layer of consciousness. We have to recognize our engagement and be part of that. So my approach does take some differences from what I understand as some of the sort of core elements of Ken Wilber's in that respect. And yeah, Terry, you may be also better positioned to reflect on with your deeper understanding of Ken's approach and your sense of mine.
Well, you know, I would say this, that there are levels of understanding of integral theory that are more, you might say, separative and kind of that stand in a presumed objectivity and are disconnected from the our common humanity and our participation in the entire, you know, non-human family. But I think that there are even more integral approaches and understandings, even of integral theory, that draw us beyond those more limited ways of experiencing it that you were just critiquing, Jeremy. So I myself don't see as deep a contradiction between what you're doing and an integral approach. In my own work, I'm in the process right now of finishing an upcoming book, which offers a vision for an even more evolved version of an integral view of the world that I call radical integral ecology. And it has a lot in common with the view you're putting forth here, Jeremy. So I'm not sure that I would see it quite the way you described it, but I'm not sure that that's something to try to get into in detail right here on this call.
Yeah,
but I would like to bring forward...
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think it would be a very interesting topic to explore further. And, you know, maybe at some point we should see what possibilities there are to do that. But I think that the question raised a really, really rich area of exploration.
Yeah, there's a great deal of potential there. I'd have to explain a lot about my sense of how integral is always becoming more and more integral. I don't regard
right.
it as a kind of crystallized, static way of looking at the world. The Aqual Catechism is just the beginning point for an increasingly integral consciousness, in my view.
Mm.
But let me ask another question. We have a number of questions that have been written in. Joel from Vancouver, Washington, has started reading the book, and he wants to challenge something about the human need for meaning. From his perspective, various searches and paths for meaning, which do seem to be part of being human, are not what is most important, and they can even be a distraction. Rather, developing methods and approaches that allow the species to flourish in the future, a phrase that you often use, Jeremy, he thinks, is where we need to focus and put our energy. Would you agree with this statement? How do you see it?
Interesting, yeah. I think, if I understand the question right, it's saying that as we look to the future, what's most important is not necessarily looking at changing where we get meaning from or something like that, but how can humans flourish most in the future? And I certainly agree with the focus that human flourishing and natural flourishing, I would add that with equal weight, is what is most important. But my sense is, a little bit when I was giving that analogy of a software system and having to shift in the operating system, that I really think mm-hmm. that ultimately we have to look at where we get meaning from in order to change some of those core elements in the operating system to lead to a true sustainable future flourishing. Because as long as we get meaning from some of the elements of what is thrust on us by the sort of corporate media, you know, more consumption, more status, all this kind of stuff that helps the whole global monetary system to sort of keep going in it the way it does. As long as and any of us sort of get meaning from that way, or the majority of us get meaning from that way, we are not headed for that future flourishing. So I think we do have to. So and that's where, you know, even techno like fixes, like we could look at something like climate change, and we could push really hard for massive investments in renewables, which of course we have to do, and we can push for a global carbon tax, which I think would be a great solution to a lot of the problems for the future. But those things would just allow that modern, this kind of global consumer system to keep going past the sort of speed bump of climate change and then keep consuming the earth more. And to really do some of these deeper shifts, I do think we have to look at the source of where humans get meaning from, because those are the things that cause our values to arise, which are what we actually live according to.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I feel that we got into the conversation in a deep and real way, and yet as you get into the richness of what this is pointing to, in a sense we open up a conversation. It's as if we've just begun. Some of the other questions that have been written in have to do with people really feeling into and intuiting a sense of a transformation of consciousness happening in their own lives and in their own experience. And that's absolutely true for me. I sense it's true for you. You're becoming activated in your deepest and truest work, which you see as joining together with other people of good faith in a new coming together. And it's really there that our friendship, or that our conversation today, that my connections with everyone who's listening, you know, have arisen from. And yet it is as if this what we know about that transformation of consciousness is insufficient. We are being urged by this crisis to get past everything we already know into a living emergence, into the next new now moment, you know, ever more conscious, ever more responsible, ever more embodying our values, ever more arriving beyond the unconscious and selfish habits that otherwise pattern our ways of being. And that's a very tender and vulnerable place of meeting. I'm sure, Jeremy, even as you're probably feeling in some ways fulfilled and excited as you launch this beautifully written book, you're also feeling how, in a sense, you've taken on a kind of piece of the responsibility for the human future, and how daunting it is to have the care for all of that as your domain of responsibility and work. And there's something very tender there, you know, and feeling that with you. I want to just invite you to speak from that tenderness.
Oh yeah, Terry, and I'm so glad you raised that concept of responsibility there, because as you were talking, you know, I was feeling into that and feeling that, you know, really, when we recognize that we are all engaged in this interconnected web of meaning around each other, in all our relationships with others and the actions that we do and everything like that. And none of us really knows in this nonlinear path which action we take, which might have the biggest ramifications in the future. You know, we really are all in that place, that sort of tender place of responsibility. And I think that is actually... And that is kind of daunting when you really realize that, you know, I'm in this network of meaning, then it kind of puts this special element of kind of sacred importance in every action we take. Just the most minor day-to-day actions with our family, with people on the street or whatever, every one of those has these ripples which may affect things in ways we can never even dream of. So that is, this both daunting is also a sense of empowering, because, you know, to get back to that first question about that sense of hopelessness, we realize that, you know, this is something, it's like this kind of complex web. Every one of us can resonate with that web, and the actions that we do can really make a difference. And so, regarding my own book and this work, I definitely do hope that it will have some of those waves and some of those ripples of making a difference out there. But I do think that every one of us, in the actions that we take and the choices we make, are doing that. And that's so important to recognize.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, I want to repeat your websites, jeremylent.com and leology.org. The name of the book is The Patterning Instinct. I highly recommend it. I also highly recommend my course, ispcourse.com, and my own website, terrypatton.com. And if you value this, you know, please let others know about it. They can register at beyondawakeningseries.com. Thank you so much, Jeremy, and thank you, everybody, for joining Jeremy and me today.
Yeah,
goodbye,
and
everybody.
Thank you, Terry, for having me on this. Bye.
Absolutely.